Welcome to the 24th episode of Who's Editing, a thought experiment in which my guest and I appoint ourselves editors of a comic book line at DC Comics. But the joke's on us because we can only use the characters of a specific issue of Who's Who, and boy, what an issue. In fact, we must use them. I'm Siskoid. I'll let you in on all the rules. But first, my guest with which to create this line of books based on Who's Who number 24, it's fellow founder of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, father to us all, the esteemed Rob Kelly. Hi, Rob.
Howdy, Siskoid. Thanks for having me on.
I had a note in my podcasting schedule, which was beg Rob to do this one because...
yeah, you had no choice, really, considering the characters in this issue.
Right. We're going to get... Ultra, the multi-alien.
Yes.
And and Tomahawk, which is also another one. Unfortunately, the rest of people, well, I say the rest of the issue, but including these characters, it's a strange issue to get. And I felt almost sorry that this is the one that that you were assigned.
Ultra, the multi-alien, man. That's, I don't care if it was 23 listings of Legion characters and Ultra, I still would have been happy with it.
All Legion characters from the 5YL.
Yeah, exactly.
And Forever People. Yeah, I mean, were there challenges? Was it hard anyway?
A couple of them. Okay, some of them I just don't. I mean, I read the Who's Who listings. In contrast to the Who's Who show I did with Shaq, I actually did read the entries for this episode. But yeah, some of them were less like, what am I going to do? Others were, I thought, relatively easy. I mean, as people will hear, some of my ideas are completely ridiculous and would never remotely be published. But what the hell?
What is challenging here is that, first of all, what are all these cowboys all of a sudden?
Yeah,
it's cowboys and it's science fiction heroes. And it's, I mean, bizarrely, there are no contemporary Earth One superheroes. None.
I guess you're right. Yeah. Looking at this list. Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So it was always like, do we bring him to the contemporary era or what do we do to make a line out of these? Let's tell the folks the rules that each episode of Who's Editing goes by. Our line of books must include a monthly series for every hero, character, or team featured, as well as any non-HQ location. If two characters share an entry, as happens here several times, we can give either a series, only one of them a series, or put them in the same series. We can give a villain or other entry their own series if we absolutely feel the need to, but can only do that for a single villain. And imagine we're coming back from some crisis or other. In my case, it is actually a crisis. So we can reboot characters, use any continuities version. It's up to us. Titles don't have to match the entries. And note that each of us is pitching our own ideas, so we'll end up with two possible lines of books. And listeners, you decide which books you actually want to read, and we'll get to play that game too. At the end of the show, I'll give each of us enough money to buy one title from the other editor's line. It forces us to pay attention to the other person. Did you have a strategy going into this?
Absolutely not.
None.
Absolutely none. It was just what ideas occurred to me. That's it.
Okay. That's legitimate. I had one. I decided that the powers that be at the WB have sold off most of DC's characters. I mean, we're in an era where they're making bonehead moves. They sold off most of the DC characters. And in other words, the unimaginable happened. I looked at to use a one of the entries. I've been asked to keep the comics going with what's left. So my DC has essentially decided to repurpose a lot of the IPs so that they resemble the high profile characters that we lost in some way. So you can really smell the desperation in the offices. That's what I'm going for. And with issue 24 of Who's Who, we have to include a minimum of 14 books in our line. And if we're insane, a maximum of 18. I'm going to hand it off to you first. And we'll do a bit of back and forth in entry order, but we'll keep our bonus villain series for the end. So it all starts with Tim Trench.
That's not a sentence you hear much in life. It all starts with Tim Trench. Okay. The one rule I very loosely tried to keep, and I think I violated some of the other listings, but generally is I'm trying to keep it as if what series would have been possible at the time of this Who's Who publication. And I don't really get into the creators. I don't really worry that much about who's writing and who's drawing any of these Imagine series, but I am, when I do come up with an idea, when I did, I'd like to think, well, okay, who would have done it at the time? And so the reason I'm bringing all this up is Tim Trench. We all know that DC editor Dick Giordano loved detective series. He was not a big fan of superheroes, despite his, you know, superb renderings of them all. But he was a Batman fan. He was a Johnny Thunder fan, you know, even though Johnny Thunder was sort of superhero. But he loved plainclothes detective. So I was like, straight up a Tim Trench book that Dick Giordano could maybe write. I mean, he did write occasionally, but he generally wasn't a writer. But a book that he would draw, and something that he could just sink his teeth into. And I think that would be this kind of thing. Obviously, Tim Trench is a member of the DC universe, the larger game. He first appeared in Wonder Woman. But, you know, in this book, he moves to a new town, maybe a real city like Chicago or something, and just sets up shop as a detective. And you just give it to Dick Giordano and just say, go to town. Just there won't be any superheroes in this book. It's going to be just film noir. Go nuts, Dick. And I think you would have enjoyed that.
Well, he was part of the pantsuit era of Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
So did Giordano perhaps already ink him, the character?
I don't know how many appearances he had. I mean, that was just before Giordano came to DC. So maybe not. I don't think Trench had a lot of appearances after that.
Yeah.
I don't know if he ever really got to draw him. But this listing by, I think it's Sandy Plunkett, him with the gun and everything. It's just, to me, this is straight over the plate for somebody like him.
In my case, I call him The Trench, since that's also a DC IP. And he's the line's Punisher. I told you we were desperate. He's draped in a massive trench coat that seems to hide an infinite collection of weapons. His favorite is still Lulu. It's a 357 Magnum who whispers sweet nothings in his ear. And the reader is witness to these conversations. And you hear Lulu, or you read Lulu. She's part Skeets, part Professor Stein, part Trench's girlfriend, who he tragically lost. But is her soul really in the gun, or is Trench quite insane? So it's a black humor book, almost played for straight. I'm going for some sort of Lobo absurd, but not quite to that level. Next up is TNT and Dan the Dynamite. So this is my first straight replacement. TNT and his sidekick are the new Batman and Robin. We darken the costumes, peg their unnamed American city as contemporary Gotham, give them a headquarters in an old mine, which matches the theme. And for TNT, an Avengers mission, because the original Dan, the Dynamite, was killed by Two-Face, was still in this issue. It hasn't stopped him from recruiting a new Dynamite, Delia, who plays the rookie discovering TNT's world at the beginning of the series. I still have TNT be a school teacher. So if he loses one mite, he recruits from the classroom. Is that grooming? TNT is Batman on the surface, but I think we might get into darker territory with him. Like what happens when a superhero is canceled within that community. So that might play out in my JLA substitute coming up soon, but that's what I'm doing with TNT.
They do need a costume change because these uniforms are rough. Based partly on events that is going on right now, you'll know what I'm talking about in a moment, and also partly based on their appearance in an issue of Super Friends, which we covered over on my show For All Mankind, where they got kind of involved in nuclear testing because of their powers. I took this as, for all of you who have seen Oppenheimer in theaters now, I like the idea that FDR realized, I always have to get FDR into one of these ideas. FDR realizes that the security needed for Los Alamos is so important that he commandeers two superheroes to be basically the local heroes of this town and ward off Nazi spies and Russian spies and all things like that, because they have to protect the work of J. Robert Oppenheimer. So basically, TNT and Dan the Dynamite become the local superheroes of Los Alamos. And everyone knows them, you know, like they don't even have their secret identities anymore. There's no point in having them. But it's set in that time frame, but it's all about them helping America, helping J. Robert Oppenheimer and the team, you know, give them the time to develop the bomb. It's kind of grim, but that's sort of what it is. It got a little bit of, you know, a little New Frontier-ish, a little Golden Age razzmatazz kind of thing. It's like, you know, slightly darker take on it, and you know, involving with TNT, involved with the government. But they would just be kind of local superheroes in this incredibly small town where everyone knows each other.
Sure. Yeah. No, I'm into it. I can't wait to hear your Barbie ripoff. Okay. Here's one of your fetish characters. Tomahawk. and Dan Hunter both could get series. I didn't go that crazy, but what did you do with Tomahawk?
All right, so I completely jettisoned Dan Hunter. I never liked Dan Hunter. Don't care about Dan Hunter. Sorry. My Tomahawk series is in tribute to the infamous Superman Salutes the Bicentennial Treasury, where on the cover it's Superman and you think for your dollar you're getting Superman stories, and you open it and it's nothing but moldy old Tomahawk reprints with just a little headshot of Superman saying, you know, here's a great adventure Tomahawk had. You're like, what the hell is this? So my tribute, and look, everyone knows, well, not everyone, but I've talked on at least several podcasts about my love for Son of Tomahawk, which was an updated series they did in the late 60s to try and save the book, where they moved the whole Tomahawk concept forward in time to where Tomahawk, forward in the time of Tomahawk, still in the past in our time, because it's set in sort of the Old West, where Tomahawk is an old man and now his son is an adventurer. And he actually got his own listing in Who's Who under Hawk. But so I decided I thought about trying to extend it even further, like maybe daughter of the son of Tomahawk. And then I was like, nah, I'm going to do all that. So I decided I'm going to restart Brave and the Bold. And the concept for Brave and the Bold, though, is Tomahawk must appear in some form in every issue. Sometimes he can be the co-star. It can be, you know, hey, the Inferior Five and Tomahawk. Sometimes he can be an unbilled guest star in the third act, you know, like, oh, look at this. Magog needs some help. And oh, here's, although he's not an 80s character, but Tomahawk shows up. Or it can literally be a billboard where Tomahawk is shown, or he's on television. It's the gist of it is he has to appear in some form every single issue. That's my tribute to the Tomahawk Superman Salutes the Bicentennial Treasury.
Tomahawk is on the cover saluting interior Superman stories.
Just something. Yes.
That's a very funny idea. For me, it's a repurposed IP completely. Tomahawk is my Green Arrow. I have to populate my Justice League. He's my Green Arrow, a Native American character who is an expert marksman with most anything, but he prefers throwing axes. Some of them are trick axes. So he works out of Frontier City, just set roughly in the contemporary Midwest. And it's where a new civil war is brewing thanks to fascist insurrectionists whose initial plans involve inflaming a situation with the natives to justify their own actions. If things get out of control in Frontier City, it'll bleed into the rest of the country. So Tomahawk is the thin flint line between order and chaos.
I'd buy that.
Tomahawk's Rangers is up next. Well, the Justice Rangers, they're my JLA substitute, of course. And Tomahawk is, of course, in it. Might even be elected leader to tie into, you know, the original entry. The members are the other Justice Leaguer homologues, including TNT. And to give you a tease, Ultraman, Tsunami, Tyrock, and Ultra the Multi-Alien, among others. And you'll see which heroes they correspond with. I like my Justice League, or pardon, my Rangers, involved in big global to cosmic stuff, since their solo titles will always kind of take place in their own little bubbles, contextualizing cities. The HQ at Valley Forge, the so-called Anvil, is run by a near-sentient computer called Stovepipe. There are vehicles at their disposal, the four-wheeled Wildcat and the flying cannonball. The base is defended by the long rifle system, and you call an alert by hitting the brass button. So you can't say I didn't read the entry. What about your Rangers?
All right. Well, okay. this idea that I came up with combines three separate listings here in this issue.
Okay.
And I can't recall too many people. Most of the time you're talking about, you know, regular series, but people have pitched miniseries occasionally, right? They had to have. I can't recall any off the top of my head.
Yes. And I think there's some people cheat, you know, and then go like, right, well, it's a series of specials, and the specials that people love, they become series, stuff like that, you know.
Okay. Well, sorts. I'm going to cheat a little bit in that this is going to be a maxi series that combines, as I said, three listings in this book, where due to some crazy timey-wimey crisis-related thing, Tommy Tomorrow and Tomahawk switch places in time. And so there is a 12-issue maxi series, which will, unlike, say, Sonic Disruptors, will actually be completed. Tommy Tomorrow will take command of Tomahawk's Rangers, and Tomahawk will take command of the Planeteers. And so they will have to navigate. It's a totally unworkable idea, but that's why it's only a miniseries. This, and they will have to navigate various challenges in their newfound worlds. And so, you know, and it'll be certainly more lighthearted than, say, Hex, when they tried to do it for Jonah Hex, so they put him into the far-flung future. And the whole point was facing various dangers and challenges, but also finding a way back to their respective times.
Fish out of water.
Fish out of water, both, yes. And it would be alternate issues, like the one issue, issue one is maybe the setup, and then two is Tomahawk and the Planeteers. Issue three, Tommy Tomorrow and Tomahawk's Raiders, and back and forth. And then the 12th issue, drawn by George Perez, double length, you know, we resolve it all.
Does that cover your Tommy Tomorrow idea as well?
I would say yes. I'm jamming both concepts because I've never liked Tommy Tomorrow. I've never found it very interesting. And so I was like, the only way I'm getting into this is like combining him with some other IP here that I like.
I've combined him with another IP for sure. The book is called The Planeteers. It is set in the 30th century. Because this is my Legion substitute. Tommy Tomorrow was actually born in our time, a bit like Captain Comet. He was like ahead of his time mentally. So he created a time machine that sent him to the future, but he found he couldn't go back. His stories about the 21st century age of heroes rally a lot of youths across the galaxy to join him and form, at their insistence, the Planeteers. He's basically the Brainiac Five of the bunch, the super genius intelligence. I'd give him a little psionic power that can form like a force field around himself. And of course, he's dressed in purple. So the other kids are all representatives of their home planets, usually take that name, whatever the planet name is. The book is about finding passion and inspiration in something new. And then we'll see a decline because as the new becomes a fad. So how do you sustain interest after that? So we've got like young people, and are they going to stay in this new team, or are they going to grow bored with it? And we're going to play with that a little bit. Matt Savage, Trail Boss. Oh, geez. For me, this was DC's answer, or my DCU's answer, to The Flash. We'll call this speedster The Bullet. The book is actually called The Savage Trail of the Bullet. I think there's always something absurd about Carmine Infantino's Central City being like this super long airport runway with a thin skyline in the back, you know? I don't think you can contain a speedster to a single city is the thing. So The Bullet covers every town from the middle of Texas to the edge of Death Valley in California. It's a lot to patrol. Does he have time for his supporting cast? His job as a CSI? So it's The Flash dropped into a larger canvas and with more of a cowboy attitude, you know, instead of the straight-laced science nerd that he used to be.
I remember even at whenever age I was when this book came out, 13, 14, I was like, why is he under T? Like, what? Yeah. Like, his name is Matt Savage. And I'm like, did they just forget? Or did they do this? And then they were like, oh, shit, we have an extra page. Matt Savage, Trail Boss. That's it, under Trail Boss.
Yeah,
that's
there are a number of characters like this. Like, Deathstroke is under T as well, right?
The Terminator, right, yeah.
So there's some people, I think, they forgot about them. And, oh, crap. Certainly Matt Savage.
Yeah.
But you had to give him a series.
So, well, my idea was, I have never read any issue of any story of Matt Savage, Trail Boss. I've never seen any issues of Western Comics where he, I think his whole series ran. So I can only go by the listing here and what I imagine the adventures are. You know, he seems, again, I'm guessing from the listing, is that there's a lot of traveling, like he's moving around a lot. So I decided to kind of invert that and do a total Unforgiven, Wild Bunch, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid kind of style, where we flash forward again, not in our future, but in his future. And he's older and he has settled down and he ends up becoming the sheriff of a small Western town. And he has decided, okay, I'm going to try and tame this down. If we really want to tie it into the greater DCU, like, you know, it's the early version of Gotham or something, where it's this lawless frontier town. He comes in as sheriff and he decides, okay, this, I am going to at least in the boundaries of this little town, I'm going to try and restore justice and fairness. And of course, again, he's older and he's getting a little tired for all this stuff and he's tired of the killing. And so he does his best to not dispense justice in a, you know, shoot him dead in the street kind of way. But it's that sort of thing. He's now a lawman. They mention in the listing some of his like side characters, Biscuits Baker, which, again, that just sounds fantastic. Maybe we could work them into the thing too. He was, his group of relation is the Dog Iron Crew, which is a fantastic name. And so I would love to work them into it. But that kind of mode of those Westerns of the late 60s, early 70s, that was all about the change of the West over. And that's kind of what this series would be. And so I'm inverting it from, it sounds like a character that traveled a lot. So every issue was going to be a different setting. This is one setting. It's, I guess it's not that dissimilar from my concept to TNT Indiana Dynamite, and that it's very centrally located in one small town, but it's still a Western and he can go off and have other adventures. But generally, that's what it is. It's like, this is, he's going to be the lawman of this town.
I have read a Matt Savage story.
Oh.
It was very like Western procedural in a way.
Okay.
Like very straight Western stories. There weren't like, you know, Silver Age aliens in it or anything. Well, let's stick with the cowboys because our next entry is the Trigger Twins.
The world famous Trigger Twins. Yeah, again, these are another sets of characters I've never read a single comic book story from. My idea for this would be maybe a miniseries, not necessarily, but immediately splitting them up. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't come up with a reason why, some contrived reason why they get separated. And the book is a not an official split book where it's like two completely separate stories, but each issue is their separate adventures. And the whole bit is kind of like them wanting to get back to one another, but getting sidetracked, having their own adventures. And then maybe it's the kind of thing where after every 12 issues, they find their way back and then we split them up again. But for a little while, it's like, let's try and delineate the differences between Walt and Wayne Trigger and give them distinct personalities. And so you get to have maybe two completely kind of different sets of adventures. You can maybe, if you wanted to, if you really wanted to be abstract, get a completely different creative team for each adventure. Mm-hmm. Different writer and artist. And then maybe once in a while, yeah, you combine them all or something like that. But I think that could be, I thought that might be kind of fun.
This was a weird shtick because wasn't it that nobody knew them as the Trigger Twins except the readers, because there was only ever one of the brothers acting as sheriff and the other one is... Like, you can be in two places at once, but that's right. The secret that they're just like, people think they're just one person. That's all academic. I didn't keep the cowboy stuff because these guys are my answer to the Wonder Twins and junior members of the Justice Rangers. Superheroes in training from a planet that was saved by the team. Wayne and Jenna can trigger, get it, their transformations by bumping fists. And you'll say, well, that's just like TNT and Dynamite, because yes, these kids figured out the magic, well, their chemical formula, used it on themselves so they could join the team that they idolize. It just had a kind of a different effect on them because they're aliens. It's the same powers as the Super Friends ones. And they are almost always kept on the sidelines in the Rangers book itself because they're considered in training. So in their own book, they get up to all sorts of fun shenanigans, trying to run before they learn to walk. These are my fishes out of water in a small town called Rocky City, which I place in the Rockies. So let's say Pacific Northwest in this case. Tsunami is next up. She's obviously my Aquaman, right? A Japanese-American hero with hydrokinesis powers. Her father is actually a Japanese national. And Mia has spent time in both countries pretty equally throughout her life, because this is contemporary era, as always. I'm always scrunching them up into the 21st century. We're going with a woman of two worlds theme, Japan and America, land and water, male and female, because I'm making Tsunami a trans hero, forced by family and duty to conform to her male birth, which has since become a secret identity that she bitterly resents. She's only allowed to live her true self as a superheroine. Since we're catching her early in the career, we get to follow her coming out, her transition, and so on, which is a journey that readers should be exposed to. And we'll, of course, have a trans writer on the book to make it legit.
Mm. This was the toughest one for me because, I mean, I read the issues of All-Star Squadron that she's in. She obviously, they brought her into the Young All-Stars. And right. I've just never really grokked all those characters. Iron Monroe and Fury, they all just, Neptune Perkins. I was like, all right, these are all just sort of the C-list versions of the characters Rick Thomas wanted to work with. And I'll tell you, my original idea was, well, you know what, maybe I shouldn't even mention that because maybe people will like the first one better than the second one. Her listing ends with this whole thing where, of course, because she is Japanese and she's fighting for Japan, and then she realizes, oh, wait a minute, they're fighting for the wrong cause, and I can't go along with this. But she also will not flip to the other side and fight for America. And her listing ends that it says what happened later to her remains to be seen. So she kind of disappears after the World War II, and we don't really ever see her again. So my concept was, and it's funny, as I'm saying them out loud, I'm realizing how many of my ideas are inspired by movies, not other comic books, which is probably why I should never be put in charge of a comic book line, because none of my inspirations really come from the medium that I'm working in. But nevertheless, this idea is Hell in the Pacific. the 1968 film with Lee Marvin and Toshiro Mifune, where these two guys, they're the only two guys in the film, and they wake up in this small island and they don't realize the war has ended. So we flash forward again. I keep coming up with these flash forwards of all these characters, but she flash forwards and somehow she wakes up on this island. Maybe her powers are still there, but they're reduced for some reason. And she has to deal with, for the first maybe bunch of issues, it's just her just surviving on this island by herself. And it's all just a wonder. It's just her. She's the only character, and she's got to find her way to survive and, you know, find shelter and find food and all stuff like that. But then, you know, various ne'er-do-wells from the war effort start showing up, whether they're not escaped Nazis or things like that. And she's got to deal with that. And she has to deal with her conflicting feelings of, well, okay, I come from an Axis powers background, but I don't like these guys are clearly the bad guys. And it's that kind of, it's like a struggle for survival. And eventually, of course, she'll make it home or something like that. But I thought that'd be kind of a fun idea to push the concept of World War II forward to that kind of idea of like where she's on an island by herself. And then she's just got dealing with different people as they wash up on the island. Hopefully it doesn't become like Gilligan's Island and it's ridiculous that just people are washing up constantly left and right. But, you know, something like that.
Turns out it was Dinosaur Island all the time.
Yeah.
That's World War II Pacific. That's where my mind goes to. All right, next up, I know you love the Legion. It's Tyrok.
Okay. All right, I take it back. This was probably the hardest one because, again, these Legion characters, I'm just like, okay. Basically, again, I forgive me, everybody, because I said I don't know the ins and outs of Legion history, and I might be violating something or whatever. But I would love the idea of doing, I'm thinking about when Tyrok first appeared, which is Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes number 216. So that's the 70s, right?
Yep.
That's square in the mid 70s. And so I would love it if we could do obviously this is set in the 30th century, but do a solo Tyrok series as if it is 70s blaxploitation. Do that kind of thing. Now, again, that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. There wouldn't be that, but I don't care. That's what I'm doing. It's that kind of wakacha, wakacha, wakacha sort of thing where Tyrok goes on solo adventures and sort of deals with more, maybe not earthbound, because he's not from Earth, right? He's not from Earth. He's from another planet.
I think it's
Marzal, an island associated with one of the alternate Earths destroyed in the recent battle with the Anti-Monitor. Like, okay.
That's how they call it in the Who's Who, but that's a retcon. I think that island was always on Earth.
Okay. All right. Well, then he is from Earth. Okay.
Yeah, it's like an African-American Brigadoon.
Okay. All right. Part of it is inspired by the illustration in Who's Who by Norm Breyfogle. I mean, the outfit that Tyrok is wearing is absurd, even by, I'd say, superhero kick. You know, he's got this enormous package there that we're sort of staring at, and he's got this thing down to his navel, and he's got these big wide brooms. Yeah, right. Exactly. That's it. When I saw it, that's kind of what I thought. And so it's just that kind of, he has these sort of earthbound, slightly grittier adventures, yet it's still in the 30th century. So people have ray guns and hover cars and things like that. But it's that sort of melding of two genres.
I love it. I mean, that's almost what I would have done myself if I had not been following this DC with all the characters shunted out of it. You know, a very evocative piece, you know, and I think that's what it should be. But I'm going, of course, a different way. Well, not necessarily a completely different way. I think we can still have that swagger. But Tyrok is my other LGBTQ+ character because he's Black Canary's replacement. So I also want him to develop feelings for our Green Arrow, which is to say our Tomahawk. But that's a Justice Rangers subplot. In his own book, he's in a volatile relationship that's proving tough to maintain given his superhero activities on Marsal Island, which is part of Puerto Rico in my DCU, but also traveling the world because Tyrok is the frontman of a reggae band that tours 6 months out of the year. He's also a proponent of gay rights and of Puerto Rico statehood. So very politically active in both his identities. Let's give this one a nice Caribbean feel with threats inspired by the area, like voodoo, pirates, those kinds of enemies. Every issue also includes a link to the DC website where you can get one of Tyrok's screams. They all have different effects. You see, and once a year, maybe a song from the band. I mean, they did it with Black Canary.
Right.
Or whatever. Yeah. I would do that with Tyrok as well. Let's make him a music star.
I love the multimedia idea. That's great.
Okay. Now we're into the ultras. We start with Ultra. My run of Ultra characters, I have tied them, almost all of them anyway, to Superman for the Ultra A entry, I offer Ultra Girl, who is a replacement for Supergirl and Power Girl, which makes sense given the other Earth origins. Each Ultra, in fact, is a refugee from another Earth, an Ultra Earth, so-called because physics are substantially different there, enough so that when you travel to our Earth, you're gifted with a version of what we know as the Kryptonian suite of powers. And like Krypton, they're also quite advanced scientifically. So during the last crisis that brought all of these changes about, the Ultra Earths were all destroyed and only few people survived. So in this case, the case of Ultra Girl, she was part of the crew of an interdimensional ark on which a third of the population meant to escape the crisis. Unfortunately, it popped out too close to our sun and only a few made it to the escape pods before the ship was fried. Ultra Girl soft lands on Earth in, I've decided, Australia, discovers her powers, and immediately starts helping people. And I want to keep an Aboriginal element in here and make her dark-skinned as well. So let's have an artist do a version of this costume. The deep V certainly makes me think of Power Girl, but on a black heroine. But other survivors, discovering their own powers, aren't so self-sacrificing. So it becomes her mission to find them and stop them from her secret lair under Ayers Rock, which is to say Uluru, in the Outback.
Collectively, you and I have thought more about Ultra than probably the entire planet since this listing. No offense to the character. Well, my idea was somewhat similar in terms of the setting, because of course the last time we saw him in pre-crisis continuity, and it mentions here in the listing that he was sent to Australia to live among the Aboriginals in Earth One and Justice League of America number 201, and like there he's finally happy because he's not simple-minded, but he's gullible. And he's easily manipulated. And so they were like, let's send him to live with a bunch of people that are sort of sweet and innocent, I guess, as opposed to, like I said, in JLA number 201, a crook meets him and immediately, you know, turns him into fighting the Justice League, as you saw in the cert print here. Anyway, my series picks up with him in Australia, like yours. I think there's, again, I apologize, everybody, with all the movie influences here, but there's a touch of Walkabout, the marvelous 1971 Nicholas Roeg movie with Jenny Agutter, where
iconic.
Because part of the, it's an absolutely fantastic movie. And I mean, part of it is the setting, like how many, there aren't really that many comic book series I can think of that are set in Australia, really. And so I would think that would be kind of a fun thing to explore that culture. We don't want him to run into Paul Hicks or anything ridiculous like that. But I mean, just exploring that world and what that's like, the Aboriginal cultures and things like that. But the one sop I will make to commercialism is the Justice League, having placed him here, will not repeat the mistake of James T. Kirk with Khan, in that they will check up on him every so often. So it means like every six issues, one of the Justice League shows up to check up on Ultra. And of course, that happens to be the exact moment that, oh, look, the Joker is here and we have to fight him off, that kind of thing. But it's mostly a solo Ultra book fighting the various crazy corners of the DC universe that happen to show up in Australia, aliens and monsters and things that live under the ground and all that kind of stuff. But then again, every so often, oh, hey, Superman's here checking up on Ultra, Batman's here checking up on Ultra, that kind of thing.
Not just Tasmanian Devil.
No, you're not just, not just Tasmanian Devil.
There's hardly anything that happens in Australia. I mean, the X-Men were set there at some point.
They were?
I don't know.
When was that?
During the Silvestri era.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because they all die. They publicly die. They walk in through this gateway. Everybody on Earth forgets, or they all think they're dead, and they don't show up on cameras, etc. And they have an Aboriginal member, Gateway, who teleports them wherever the action goes. Yeah, it happened. but you're right. The DC universe, especially, the invasion comes, they destroy Melbourne. There's some action then. Tasmanian Devil, that's about it. Your concept of taking movie ideas and turning them into comics is perfectly legit. I mean, comics as a medium are a Frankenstein's monster, and they do that all the time as well, you know?
Sure.
For good or ill. What about Ultra Boy?
All right, Ultra Boy. I'm not going to go into any Legion bashing here or anything like that. I think of all the major members of the Legion, Ultra Boy, probably one of the more prominent. I like his costume and stuff like that. And so I am going to kind of backdoor this series, and then I'm going to do Ultra Boy and Phantom Girl combined series, because they're a couple. They're married. And one of the things I always found so frustrating about DC's treatment of the Hawks was they never seemed to be able to quite, and as much as I liked Tony Isabella's Shadow War, the Hawkman and stuff like that, I loved all that stuff. Before that, like, you know, that series was created because they felt, DC felt like the Hawks needed to be like refreshed as a concept. I, even as a kid, I was like, super cool husband and wife team using old weapons, but they're in a spaceship and they're space cops. Why is this so hard? Like, why can't you guys do this? I don't understand why this is so hard to pull off. So I'm kind of using other characters for that concept where Ultra Boy, Phantom Girl, the book is about them as a couple. They're off having adventures, but it is partly inspired by one of my favorite listings in Who's Who, which is the Phantom Girl listing by, I think it was Jaime Hernandez. Which one of the Hernandezes, but I love that listing so much. I love that they got him to do it. I love that they, like, I just thought that was such a great idea of using some independent artist to do that, to do a character you would not associate with them at all. And so I would love to see an Ultra Boy Phantom Girl series done by like the Hernandez brothers, that kind of, you know, bright kind of teenage adventure sort of thing, but set in the DC universe, but out in outer space. So, and I would love to read them as like married superheroes. I don't think we still get enough of that. So I would, that's again, it's mostly a Phantom Girl series, not an Ultra Boy series, but they're married. So there you go. Ultra Boy and Phantom Girl, the series.
Hernandez also did the Shrinking Violet entry. So
that's right. That's right.
She can show up as the cool aunt to their kid. Yes. If they ever get it. I mean, they had a kid in one of the continuities, but we don't know that it's going to happen here. Ultra Boy for me. Well, another survivor of a doomed Ultra Earth. Ultra Boy survived in a most unusual way. He was, I mean, it's like the entry, he was joyriding in a stolen one-man craft when he was swallowed by a space whale. And while he's in the belly of the beast, the crisis happens and the creature manages to slip into an interdimensional crack, into the bleed, and then into our world. When Jonah escapes, he finds he has all these powers, although he can only use them, you know, one at a time. He sets himself up in Europe, figuring on acting like a backpacking teen just out of high school. It's a good cover for someone who's hiding a fact that he's from a parallel Earth. Having been a young offender also gives him some useful skills. But though at first he's tempted to use his powers for profit, he soon finds that using them to help people is a lot more rewarding. So we're having a lot of fun with this title, giving Joe some travel companions he meets at various hostels and changing up the locations fairly often to give the comic some nice variety. This is our Superboy, essentially. And well, here's our Superman, in my case, Gary Concord, the Ultraman, these entries. On his Earth, Gary Concord was the equivalent of the President of the United States. I would keep this alternate history with him being born on a World War I battlefield, his attempts at failing really to stop World War II by bringing a golden age of technology, the chemical accident that made him super strong and tough, and then becoming leader of the free world and bringing peace to all nations. That happens on his Earth. Then the crisis hits. He's selected as one of the heroes to fight it. When the DCU settles, his world is gone, and he's in our metropolis with his powers even more amplified, so he's easily the most powerful of the Ultras. From there, we definitely ditched this costume, so have at it, artist of choice, and we place him in Superman-type stories. So he's a man who lost his world and wants to do his best for his adopted home, but doesn't try to run for office or change the world with super tech, because in any case, the differences in physics means that they don't, you know, the same tech doesn't work anyway. He's a bit like a real world refugee or immigrant who was a doctor at home, but he's a cab driver in the States, you know, that kind of trying to find opportunities. And like our Superman, he's hiding in plain sight. No one realizes that simple blue collar guy recently engaged to a woman called Leandra is in reality Ultraman. And since Leandra is the daughter of a villainous Luthor-like businessman, we also get a bit of a soap opera from keeping her in the story.
There are a lot of grown men in shorts in this issue.
It's a summer issue.
It's got to stay cool. So, okay, this is another character that I've never read a story from. I doubt these have ever been reprinted anywhere. He first appeared in All-American Comics number 8, which even predates Green Lantern. I mean, I just noticed this, too. Maybe we talked about it when Shag and I covered this, but he's 6'8". I didn't realize.
He's massive. Yeah,
he's a 300-pound, 6'8 guy. So he's this huge dude. I mean, I see the way Marshall Rogers draws him, but I'm like, I don't have any frame of reference. He's just a tall guy. So to me, I guess the appeal of this strip, and again, I only have this listing to go by, and the reason why, like, you know, Marshall Rogers, you know, it was like a big name. And like, why is he doing this? Why is he drawing the listing for this kind of zero character that I'm genuinely shocked got a listing, to be honest?
Yeah. The entry is better than the strip.
Okay. Have you read any of those?
I've read some.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, it's like those Buck Rogers strips from the same era. It's totally a ripoff of that kind of look.
Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. But I'm guessing part of the appeal of this, from the look and the fact that they even bothered to do it, give him a listing, is sort of the retrofuturism. Like, oh, okay, these stories were done in the 1940s. And this is what in the 1940s they thought the world would look like in the future, or this parallel universe of the future. Very Metropolis, very H.G. Wells's Things to Come. Again, I'm sorry for all the film references, everybody. So my idea is, for reasons I've not come up with yet, Ultraman gets put to sleep or goes into a deep freeze, goes into some parallel universe, something that just gets rid of him. And then he wakes up thousands of years in the future. And the world that he wakes up in, again, which is this parallel Earth, is way beyond him. So he is no longer the Ultraman. He's no longer kind of an advanced. He's behind in his new world. He's no longer like this advanced person. He is part of an advanced world where he's comfortable. He is now having to play sort of catch up. And of course, because he's got high intellect, he'll start getting up to speed very quickly. But it's again, another fish out of water kind of idea. But part of it is that it would be drawn by Marshall Rogers and Terry Austin, because I think part of the appeal of this strip would be the settings. I mean, you can see in the surprint these ridiculous, not ridiculous, actually pretty kind of cool, you know, buildings and all this complicated hardware. And Marshall Rogers loved drawing that stuff.
Right, architecture, yeah.
Yes, architecture. I mean, we all are familiar with Marshall Rogers and Terry Austin's run on Batman, a detective, where we were treated to these sumptuous vistas of Gotham City with 1,000 buildings and all these fire escapes and all these towers. And it's the kind of thing where a lot of artists would just do it in silhouette because they don't have the time or the interest. Marshall Rogers would draw all that. And I think he was into that. So I think part of the appeal of the strip would be the idea of a futuristic world. So the old Ultraman strip is retrofuturism. The new book is current futurism, that what we think in 1985, what the world of 3525 is going to look like.
You can sell a book on art alone. It's perfectly fine, you know?
Yeah.
Again, don't apologize for the movie references. We've got three entries left, so I expect a Jaws, a Before Sunset.
it's a mad world.
Well, maybe this one's a mad world. We're finally here.
Yes. Ultra,
the multi-alien.
Yes. Oh, I love this character so much. Okay. I actually decided to keep it sort of simple for this. Now, I'm not cheating. My dream artist for this book would be John K. Snyder. But John K. Snyder did the listing for Ultra in the loose leaf edition, and this is before all that. So we're not going to cheat and say somehow he gets tapped, because John K. Snyder, I think, was working in comics at this point. Maybe not. Maybe this is just before that. But I'm not going to cheat and say, let's get him on the book or anything like that. So
he did some Suicide Squad, which means that could have been like
late 87, 88, 89,
something like that.
He did the Classics Illustrated, some of those when first brought that series back, and that was the late 80s. So this might have been just before that. But my idea for Ultra, first of all, it would be a, not a split book, but it would be a Ultra book with him as the main feature, of course, because he headlines his own title. But then and that would just be straightforward Ultra adventures, because the character never really got that much of a shake. I mean, he only made about 8 appearances in Mystery in Space before the strip got canceled. Now, he's guest appeared here and there, but it wasn't like he had some long run that we're like, oh, well, really exhausted this concept. It's like, well, he only did eight of them. So just do a regular Ultra book having him adventures. But the backup strip would be similar to Tales of the Green Lantern Corps, which was always one of my favorite things about I never was a big fan of Green Lantern, but I always liked the Tales of the JL Corps strips, because they would, you know, focus on a lesser known member of the Corps, and it would be done by a creative team that normally you didn't see doing a DC superhero book, like say Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill or something like that. But because Ultra is made up of four different aliens from four different worlds, the backups would be adventures on all those planets. So it would be a rotating series of backups. So one issue is the alien race from the one that looks like the chicken leg, the one hand, you know, and the one planet where he looks like he's like all pure energy, and the other one where he's the green guy, and the other one where he's the blue guy. And we just kind of rotate them. So we get insight as to what the worlds are that he is coming from. While the main strip is just straight ahead, Ultra the Multi-Alien Adventures.
Well, we're somewhat on the same wavelength because he's my replacement for Green Lantern.
Not great.
So, yeah. In this case, a member of Universo's multi-alien core. So we imagine a benevolent but cold and calculating Universo who started an intergalactic police force made up of species from all over. Arn Ace is our last Ultra, a refugee from a destroyed Earth, but one that's closer to our own scientifically, so maybe Golden Age Superman level in terms of powers when he gets here. After he arrives, he's recruited because that's how the multi-alien core works. Instead of a ring that creates constructs, they can instead share abilities between them. It's the ultimate Idic from Star Trek, right? Infinite diversity, infinite combinations. So he can borrow Brawlian magnetism or Imskian shrinking or turn into a birdman or an energy creature, whatever alien abilities that the DCU has spawned. And these abilities are non-trademarkable, so we didn't trade them away with whatever WB deal was made. In exchange, other members of the Corps can borrow his amazing strength and jumping over tall buildings and so on. Ultra is Earth's prime defender against alien invasions and criminals from other worlds. And sometimes he joins other Corps men on special missions.
Yeah, love it. Like I said, anything where he's a main member of the DC universe, I'm happy.
Okay, next up is Uncle Sam. And this one I actually call Uncle Sam and the American Presidents. And it's loosely based on a role-playing game I designed as an example of game design on my blog in 2009. It was called Extraordinary League of Presidents then, and it had the Illuminati preserve every American president, many other founding fathers, leaders from other countries, using magic and eventually science. Presidents that then acted as superheroes headquartered at the Washington Monument, which doubled as a rocket, and at Mount Rushmore. And you were aware of this, Rob, because you commented on the post. 2009, okay. We were babies.
Wow.
Anyway, this version has Uncle Sam do the heavy lifting instead of some secret society. And he leads a team of regulars that include Washington, who can force you to tell the truth. Lincoln, who is a giant stone statue because he is the memorial. FDR in his pimped out combat chair and electrically powered Ben Franklin, and so on. They fight the likes of Hitler's brain and rogue presidents like Nixon and so, you know, stuff like that. It's historical parody with big, bold action, kind of like Roy Thomas meets action philosophers.
That's a hell of an elevator pitch, just that. Roy Thomas meets action philosopher. All right. So it was so funny. My first concept was like Uncle Sam traveling through time, visiting various events in America's history, which was partly inspired by Captain America's Bicentennial Battles, the Treasury Edition. But then I realized that Alex Ross already did that when they did the two-issue miniseries. Right. So I was like, oops, no wonder it was such a great idea. It's already done. So my idea was, okay, I know that post-crisis, there is no Earth-X, but I'm skipping all that. This is, in my world, the crisis didn't happen. Chris Franklin's happy about that. And so it's Earth-X, where, for people who don't know, the planet is run by Nazis. That would never happen here. And the heroes that are there fighting against the Nazi powers are the Freedom Fighters. And he's the leader of the Freedom Fighter, Phantom Lady, Human Bomb, Doll Man, the Ray, all those characters. And I normally don't like this as a setup because I find it's cheap, but I'm willing to go with it for this one-off idea, is that the book opens where the world government, these Nazis that run everything in this on this Earth-X, decide to basically really get serious, and they kill all of the Freedom Fighters, except Uncle Sam. He manages to escape. And so the book is The Fugitive, where these world governments that are run by these Nazi powers are trying to constantly catch Uncle Sam. And of course, his costume is incredibly noticeable. So he has to kind of go undercover. It's got a little bit of the Incredible Hulk TV series in it, you know, that kind of thing where he's fighting to inspire people to fight back, because the ennui has set in, as because of course it would, that once, you know, you've got these people, these jackbooted thugs running everything, people just give up and say it's hopeless. So he has to kind of do it quietly, to be, he has still to be Uncle Sam and inspire people into action, but he's got to do it while also making sure he doesn't get captured, because as he knows, he's basically the only man left on the planet that is a superhero, because the rest of them have been, in the initial setup, have been killed. So it's just him.
I like it. Now we're up to the bonus series. Did you pick another entry to get a book?
Absolutely. There was only one choice.
Oh.
Two-Face. This listing is by Brian Bolland. It's an absolutely marvelous listing. It's probably, you know what, let me take out the probably. It's the best listing in the book. It really is. Even though it's got, this book has my beloved Ultra, the Multi-Alien, and Tomahawk. This listing is just the absolute bee's knees of two Harvey Dent staring at you right at the camera, flipping his quarter, and you know, we see him battling Batman, and it's just absolutely, yeah, I just wish all the Batman villains had been given this level of listing. And so my idea was partly inspired by a more modern series, the She-Hulk book. Obviously that's like, you know, more a humor derived book, but this book would be Harvey Dent, Attorney at Law. And in this book, we're going to learn that, and we probably already know this, that Batman is not great at the legal details. You know, he's good at arresting the Penguin and the Joker and trussing them up and leaving them attached to a lamppost in front of GCPD with a note that says, "Here, Commissioner Gordon," but he doesn't follow through. And so Harvey Dent uses his ability to be, you know, he's certified as a lawyer. He's a certified attorney. And he decides to use his name recognition as a supervillain to rack up clients who want to get off. And so it's going to be kind of a procedural book, kind of a comedy book. And occasionally Batman or Bruce Wayne will show up. But it's Two-Face defending various villains and getting them out of the trouble that they find themselves in. And some cases, maybe even he'll be like, "Oh my God, I don't like this Dr. Double X guy. I actually do want to see him go behind bars. But it's kind of a comedy book. It's the lighter side of what goes on in Gotham City after Batman has departed the scene.
Yeah, the second Ambush Bug miniseries, Son of Ambush Bug, ends with Harvey Dent being both the prosecutor and the
defense
attorney, right?
That's right.
That's kind of that. That idea. It's like, I'm not sure about this double X guy. Flip a coin. Well, move over, district attorney. I'm prosecuting this time. But I'm your client.
And all this stuff, like just all the comedy of like having someone like Dr. Phosphorus sitting in your office, setting your desk on fire because he's made of radiation, you know, just all the very stuff that the villains would have to deal with, but sitting in an office.
I had not just one choice. I had several options, I think, based on my premise. Tyr as a cyborg stand-in, or maybe the Trickster could have been a hero, or Tokamak as Firestorm / Iron Man, or Universo straight up being the Green Lantern. Instead, I'm filling my Wonder Woman niche, because that's my missing member in the Justice Rangers, with the Titans of Myth entry, giving it over to Themis specifically as the Titan of Justice. We're going to buff her up some, of course. I mean, she's essentially Diana without the lasso in this series. Instead of Amazon Island, we have a shadowy Tartarus where the Titans are holed up. Themis is out there as the arm of justice, but her twin, Iapetus, I'm going to say, stays home and acts as ultimate judge, which will create conflict between them. The other Titans can be used as allies or villains in the stories. And as with the Perez era of Wonder Woman, we're dipping quite a lot into Greek myth in this one. And since there are no real supernatural or fantasy characters in this particular DCU, we can be more cohesive about it and make the Greek gods and Titans like the singular supernatural influences on the world. Maybe they murdered all the other pantheons or, you know, to get where they are. Though I think I would like to use Trigon as a big bad at some point, since he's one of the few characters that my DC has retained the rights to. All right. So I've got my Wonder Woman. I've got my Justice League entire. And that's done. So finally, I guess we follow the well-established tradition that states we have only enough money to buy one series from the other editor's line. Which one will it be?
Well, all right. I've been jotting down the concepts, the ones that my favorite ones of yours has been going on. And I, of course, initially thought, well, it's going to be Tomahawk because you kind of went slightly more straightforward. And I want to read that. But then you came up with some other. And then I really like the Tyrock idea, the multimedia idea of it, the Caribbean influence. I can imagine like Legion of Superheroes mixed in with a little like Jimmy Cliff, The Harder They Fall kind of thing. Like, that's really cool. But I think I think it's like 51-49. I think you ultimately won me over with your Uncle Sam idea. Just Uncle Sam dealing with, like, they saved Hitler's brain, that kind of stuff. Like, that to me would be so fun. Uncle Sam, but done in like a 50s, 60s exploitation idea. So I think I'm going to go with Uncle Sam.
I think this series would be crazy as well. You know, Hamilton shows up rapping, you know, it's going to do stuff like that, probably. All right, Uncle Sam. All right. You had a lot of good series as well, like the Ultra Boy. That's totally, you know, speaking my language, the sexy married superhero couple. I love that kind of stuff, etc. Your Tyrock was also one of my favorites. But I'm going back all the way to TNT in Los Alamos. I mean, I also went to see Oppenheimer.
Right.
recently, this week. But regardless of my feelings about the film, that's a great idea for a setting. I mean, we also had Asteroid City this year. It's kind of the same, you know, like desert town.
Mm-hmm.
I think this would be an interesting series that could be fun, like Golden Age fun, but also at the same time, talk about like more serious ideas. So That's the one I will plunk down my, what's a comic worth, $7, whatever they cost.
We're holding the line at $6.99.
I'll be reading it on digital. Thank you. Well, so
okay.
On the app. So, all right. Well, we have bought our comics. All that's left to do really is tell you, dear listeners, you can go to fireandwaterpodcast.com and tell us what you think. Would you read any of these books? If you were in charge, what series would you offer using these characters? And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FW podcast, like Diablo Frank, who sponsors this show. I hope you had fun, Rob.
Absolutely. Like I said, you pitched this to me, I think, when you first started the show. You were like, okay, 2 years from now or two. You
know? Yeah.
And I was like, okay, well, that's who knows? We'll be living in, right? We'll have rocket cars by then. I'm not going to worry about it. And now here it is. So, but yeah, I apologize, everybody, for how many movie ideas these things were all inspired by. But that's just where my head is at now. I think maybe a bunch of years ago would have been slightly different, but I think this issue, reading this issue over, and I actually pulled out my hard copy and I'm waving it here in front of me. It reminded me how much I loved Who's Who kind of all over again, because Shag and I are, of course, several years out from having covered this series, having just, you know, relatively recently completed the Loose Leaves. But like the fact that DC would go with this format and publish a comic like this with such non-marquee stars, I just find that so charming. You know, I feel like if they had to do it nowadays, they'd be like, we got to get a Batman character in here. But they just did, like, the main character on this cover is Ultra Boy. You know? Yeah. Like, I just find it so charming that, like, this issue is so loaded down with genre stars. And it was nice to, like, reread these listings. So thank you for inviting me on, Siskoid.
It had better villains. It had like big villains.
Yeah. Ultra Humanoid. Yeah. Dragon. Yeah. Yeah. Two-Face. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, as far as the heroes go, I was like, oh man, this is tougher than I, because I thought, oh, well, Rob, you know, he's just got 14 entries to cover. That's quite doable. You know, he'll be happy with that. But it's like, oh,
Toy Man. Oh boy. Titano.
But I'm glad it worked out. Anything you want to talk about that you're working on right now on the network?
Well, we all know I've got a whole bunch of different shows. I got a lot of plates spinning. We're still in the summer, so Mountain Comics is going, of course, and I'm working on Treasury Cast. I guess I think by the time that you'll hear this, the August episode will have not yet been out, but that's going to be, I have a very exciting guest lined up for that one. And of course, For All Mankind is heading into the back, not the back nine, like the back, I don't know, whatever the percentage would be, but the final six episodes of For All Mankind. And that show will be wrapped up in January. So that's exciting. Like, much, actually, you know, very similar to this, when I first started For All Mankind, I didn't really think about it, what the commitment I was making, when I was like, oh, I'll do this once a month, it'll be fine. And then I'm like, oh my God, I've just committed myself to 4 years of monthly shows. And now we're getting near the end of it. And so that's exciting. I'll miss the show, but I'm also looking forward to some new challenges. So even though the show is, you know, getting near the end, I hope people check it out.
It's a good one. Speaking of commitments, I mean, I'm trying not to think of the commitments I made with Ohatmu or not. So that That one. We're finally at the S. The letter S is pretty far, considering. We've only been doing this for 8 years. Wow. All right. Well, on that, thank you for trying the experiment with me. And until next time, who's editing? We are.
Uncle Sam was my totally unrelated to prior properties kind of content. I did it with Vertigo, not to keep things all with DC per se, but because it was the right audience, I felt, for the subject matter, for the meaning of it. It should almost come out every new election cycle.